Culture eats strategy for lunch, and informed cultures drive decisions, inspire action. At the Data Culture Podcast, we meet with execs, visionaries, and data experts so that you may move from idea to outcome in your own data culture journey. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. My name is Sid Atkinson, data culture innovator and consulting leader with over 21 years in data. Joining us today is Oki Mek, who has the unique distinction of being the first chief AI officer in the federal government. Welcome, Oki.
Thank you, Sid. It's good to be here.
And Oki, I reached out to you because I do a lot of work with HHS, and I noticed that y'all had published back when you were with HHS, the federal HHS, you had published an AI standards and policies document. But before we get into that, so there's a couple things. You're going to talk to us today about AI strategy, what are AI sandboxes and data brokerage. But your career, your kind of line to data wasn't straight. So before we get into the three things you're going to help us with, walk us a little bit. How did you land in data?
Yeah, definitely. So I started my career at Department of Energy as a contractor. This is going to age me a little bit, but I used to be a cold fusion developer back in the day. I started off as a developer, did some sysadmin work, also did some IT project management. And then in 2002, the FISMA Act came out. For those that are not familiar with the FISMA Act, for any system, IT system, that are funded or managed by federal government has to falls under FISMA Act, meaning that it has to be assessed for security requirements as well as authorized by authorizing official, maybe a CIO or CISO. So when that first came out, nobody wanted to fill out the documentation. There's thousands of pages, thousands of requirements. So I just raised my hand because I was IT project manager at the time, but I had the information. So that's how I got into security. Really, it's really around the governance, risk management, and compliance, the GRC, which I thought at the time was still today, a good entry into cybersecurity. You are not looking at cybersecurity in a silo approach. You look at cybersecurity in a 360 view, meaning at access management, business processes, personnel security, physical security, change management, everything that covers in cybersecurity is under the GRC. So I thought that was a good entry into GRC, but I wanted to learn more. So I started looking at other business processes within the government as well. I managed some financial system, some acquisition system as well, did some personnel security as well. In the government, they call them red tapes, but the more you understand and tying to the mission and the business into security, I thought at the time, or even today, that I would become a better cyber expert. And then I started looking at data and emerging technology as well. As you said, emerging technology is moving so fast, like rapidly moving so fast. Government tends to move a little bit slower in terms of adoption of all this emerging technology. I started looking at AI as I move up, started working closely with the Secretary's office at Health and Human Services. And then at the time, the Deputy Secretary, Mr. Eric Horgan, was working closely with the White House in terms of all the executive orders were coming out. And then he had the foresight that, hey, this is coming down the pipe, is going to affect not only Health and Human Services, but a government agency across the federal government. He said, we need a chief AI officer. This is back in 2019. This is way, way back then. And then since I was working closely with him in his office under the HHS Reimagine, he said, hey, okay, you would be perfect as a chief AI officer. So that's how I became the first chief AI officer back in 2020. So now everything that you started looking in terms of the OMB AI memo that came out in March of 2024, a lot of that stuff, we have done it back in 2020 at Health and Human Services. So we were the guinea pig, so to speak. So that's how I came to be as the first chief AI officer. But now I'm at Microsoft as a CISO for Microsoft Federal Civilian. There's an old saying that you have to feed your wallet, but you also have to feed your soul as well. So if you look at my career, I've always been a civil servant, so to speak. I've done 4-H, I've done Habitat for Humanity, was in the military for 9 years, was in the government for 19 years. So when I got out, I really want to stay close to the government and continue to serve the federal government, so to speak. So that's my story.
It's interesting. If I could do a distribution, and I don't have a distribution of this because it's all clocked up in my head, but there's not many people that you see that came into leading AI positions or leadership from the security angle. So I think that gives you a neat, unique perspective. From your state, before we start talking about AI strategy, AI sandbox, but again, it's one of the questions I had for you. What do you think, starting with that GRC mindset, has helped you in kind of your AI leadership? And I have one thought just from something that it started this whole conversation. But
if you look at a lot of the CISO in the private industry and in public, half of them comes from the GRC, Governance Risk Management Compliance, because you get to look at everything in a 360 view. You got some privacy folks as well, some from finance because you are managing risk, and then you got technical folks as well. For my career working at in the GRC space my whole career, it's not just about security. It's about the culture. It's about the workforce. It's about the mission and the business that encompass security. And I took the same approach with AI as well. One thing that I've learned to become a good CISO is that you have to be a good strategist. You have to be flexible because there's no one size fits all. The business and the mission will continue with or without security. If you make it very tough, the business and the mission will continue with or without it. And then you have to be a good educator as well. Because let's say in the industry, if you want to do something, like you want to do multi-factor or you want to do zero trust, you have to convince the board that this makes sense and this makes sense to the business and the mission of the organization. In some cases, it's to the bottom line as well. But in the federal space, it's very heavily regulated. Anything that I did in the government, it has to tie to the business and the mission and all the laws and regulation that comes with it. Mm-hmm. So I took that approach when I became the first chief AI officer that I have to work with the workforce. I work with academia. I work with industry a lot, to be honest with you, because I knew that a lot of the AI bill were not going to be built inside the government because it's hard to retain talent. That we need to include industry, the major companies and folks that were in the AI space. And then, of course, academia has been researching on ethics and responsible and safe AI for years. And then the operating division, HHS is fairly large, so you have to work with the operating division to approach it with diversity and inclusion as well. So I took that experience from GRC and then apply it into the AI space.
Oh, that's awesome. I don't often hear people describe CISO with strategy and education and being a good strategist and good educator in there. But also at the same time, I will admit my biases. Usually I'm hearing about how other people describe the CISO versus like how the CISOs describe themselves. Because it's one of those things where unfortunately a lot of clients and engagements we come in, it's like the thought of introducing us or engaging the CISO comes last. And so probably need to move that conversation for us.
You want to manage risk for an organization. I see a lot of CISO in the big org now.
Yeah.
They're more of a business leader with security background. And that's what I see myself as a business leader more than a super technical. Because in the government, if you want to move up in the ranks, you have to become more strategic, policies and laws and regulation oriented than a super technical person. Because there's so many red tape, so many stakeholders, and tying it to the mission and the business.
Now, so on the topics that we're going to talk about today, AI strategy, the sandbox, data brokerage, how much of those 3 points, so when we were discussing this last week, how much of those 3 points relate to the CMS AI playbook that y'all worked at? HHS, the HHS playbook that y'all worked at. Are those related to, have you evolved those since then? Is there, to set those topics up, should we talk a little bit about the history of the playbook that you worked over at HHS?
Yeah, we could talk a little bit about the history of why, right? When I was an AI officer, people always ask me, like, why the heck do we need a chief AI officer in the federal government? And my argument was that we, GAO and OMB has always request some sort of an AI inventory in terms of how many AI projects are happening across the federal agencies. At the time, this is back in 2020, we had over 115 AI use cases that were going on within just Health and Human Services alone. And that's just the folks that reported to us. I'm sure there's more.
Yeah.
And that's back in 2020. But then I read Gartner, there's Gartner studies that mentioned that 85-86% of AI projects, not just within the government, but across the industry as well, 85-86% of the AI project doesn't see production. It could mean that it's an MVP, a proof of concept, you could classify as failure, but I don't want to say that, but it doesn't see production.
Mm-hmm.
If 85-86% of AI project within health and human services doesn't see production, I think we are at the time we could increase the success rate, so to speak. I don't want to say waste money, but we could definitely increase the success rate for the department. And that's why I believe that a chief AI officer is necessary in a major agency. Small agency is a little bit tougher. You have small micro agency, independent agency that has 50, 100 employees in the government, but like Health and Human Services, which is one of the bigger agency, I think you need a chief AI officer. So you need, I'm referencing the OMB AI memo that came out in March, but I'm also referencing what we did back in 2020 as well. So I think you need a chief AI officer. You need an AI strategy. That's a must. We got to figure out what's what, what's going on. We got to tie it to, for us, we had to tie it to health mission, the operating division and their mission as well, not just headquarters and the staffing division as well. So we need to tie the AI work with the mission and the business. So you need AI strategy. You need an AI council, meaning that we didn't, sometimes headquarters tend to make policy and kind of shove it the operating division, staff dev or boroughs, the sub agencies throats. So we didn't want to do that. We want to make sure that each operating division had a voice in how we carry out the strategy. They had a voice in the strategy, but also how we carry it out as well. So every agency needs an AI council, in my opinion. So you can include diversity and inclusion as well. Civil rights folks wanted to talk to us. And it's not just a mission, it's not just this major division, but also some of the small division as well. Like acquisition plays a major part into it. Finance play a part into it. HR as well. How do we upscale our workforce? As we move into this AI work, the AI community of interest was very important to us. We see that a lot of people were doing AI, but they were not sharing lessons learned or best practices. That wasn't that support, centralized support system. And we weren't sharing technology as well. We could be doing the same thing like linear regression or neural network, supervised, unsupervised learning to mine data. There were a lot of things going on, but there was a lot of overlaps as well. So having that community of interest and sharing lessons learned and best practices, we saw that at the time that it would increase the success rate. And then the two other things that I want to do, and I'll pause here, but I don't want to, because it's a lengthy conversation. Yeah. It's a sandbox and a data brokerage, which I wanted to do, but we didn't have the budget for it.
Gotcha. And you said something I think that's really important to get to on the AI strategy piece, right? Is that you answered it twofold there. And that when a lot of folks, when you talk about AI strategy, they think about AI strategy as an outwardly focusing thing. What, in your case, what is HHS going to do in its service to other agencies, other states, and to the constituents, i.e. citizens in the country, residents? But you also then very distinctly mentioned internal pieces too, right? That can get lost in the strategies. Think all the strategies all outwardly focusing. But you talked about the need for the officer, the council, policies, processes. So talk a little bit about your lessons there on what makes you, when you're looking at, does this client, because now you're working with clients, does this client have a good AI strategy? How are you gauging that?
Yeah, so the health sector is not confined to just health and human services.
Yeah.
You got the VA, you got Social Security, you got Defense Health Agency and other agency as well that deals with health data, as well as state and local as well.
Mm-hmm.
But also the industry, the academia as well is handling health data. And not this is back in 2020. And now data sharing that's coming down, that's this big data paradigm shift. People are going to be sharing data across the sector, not just one agency in a silo. So having that input and not doing it in silo makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But also, we didn't have the authority to write policy, an AI policy at the time. I don't know if that's changed. So we have the executive orders, and that was it. We have I don't think this AI risk management framework existed back then.
Mm-hmm.
So we just had some recommendation, so to speak, and some guidelines from the White House. So in terms of writing policy, we work with the CISO, the chief information security officer, we work with the chief data officer, the CIO as well. and piggyback off their current policy, meaning there's a security policy, so we just piggyback that and adding AI component to that policy. Privacy, they have a policy, we try to piggyback off that, as well as acquisition as well, because we want to know what we're buying, right, in terms of technologies and who owns the data as well. The data gets very messy. Who owns it? Not only the data that goes into it, but also the data that's being generated or the outcome of the data, of the derivative data that comes out from there. So we want to jump on that policy as well. So that's why we have to take a holistic approach, not just from a policy perspective, but also from the mission and the business as well, but also from a culture as well. It's a lot of education around this. Like, why are we doing what we do? Always start with the end in mind, right? Is this even making sense? Why are we doing it? If it doesn't add value, why are we doing it?
So as y'all were working through the strategy, and again, you can talk about HHS, you can talk about post-HHS, what have, both at HHS and other places, what has surprised you as you've rolled out these changes as both things that were more difficult than you thought and then things that were easier than you thought when you were working with the agency partners or with your customers? You go from, hey, this is what a good strategy looks like. You got to have, you know, what is the mission? What is the business? You know, internally, what is the culture? What are your policies? What are your practices? So now you start to define how you build a good strategy and what you have to impact. But as you rolled out, like, and we can start with HHS, what was something that was easier than you expected it to be?
It was easier because I was at Health and Human Services for 12 years. I was working at a headquarter. So I had existing relationship, but also past success as well. And that helps a lot, so to speak. But I think when people ask me why were we doing what we're doing and why we need a chief AI officer, or even now, why are we implementing M2131, Zero Trust? Why are we aligning with the NIST AI risk management framework? Those questions tend to be technology centric, but I always try to step back in terms of, let's try to approach this from a mission and business perspective. Let's look at the big picture. Mm-hmm. Even the two articles that I wrote with my colleagues here at Microsoft, Cyber Data Lake, which I think is the future, and then Responsible and Secure AI Sandbox article. Mm-hmm. The first two articles, we start with looking at the mission and the business and the laws and regulations and the culture and the ecosystem that's here right now. We didn't even mention any technology at all, like zero. You always have to start there. Like, always start with the end in mind. Is this going to help the business and the mission? And also the workforce as well. And then once you figure that out, and then you go down to the technology. But sometimes a lot of folks tend to start with technology and it gets very hairy and muddy. I think the lessons learned there is to start with the business and the mission and the end in mind. Like, why are we doing what we're doing? Is it going to add value? That's the best lessons learned that I've learned.
And I think in part of one thing I heard in that story you just said there is for organizations that are looking for either going to be the first time doing this chief AI officer role for their, whether it's full-time or whether they are pointing somebody at, hey, I need you to wear this hat for a little while because maybe the organization's not big enough. There's something that you said in your appointment there that helped it to be successful at HHS, right? Like, you were there for a while, you knew the business, you knew what the mission of the agency very well, you had past experience. So when you're coming in and you have the trust in the org, right? That is an important thing. So sometimes for people looking on the outside in, hey, Oki doesn't have a PhD in math or science, right? But that wasn't required to get the job done, right? That wasn't necessary for, it wasn't required that you were deep in the weeds on neural nets or anything like that. You knew the tech and knew how it needed to be applied for the mission of the business and then knew the culture, right? And so for folks looking at who might be the right person for a particular role, right, there's that, it's a holistic view of what's good for the role, not just a technical view of what's good for the role, isn't it?
Yeah, to answer that, Sid, it's not a technical role.
Yeah.
It's not a data scientist or AI architect or AI scientist. It's an executive role where you have to become, to think like an executive, so to speak. For folks, I had the advantage of being there for 12 years and had built relationship and understand the business and the mission and the landscape and the culture and the workforce as well. But I think for some folks that are stepping into a new agency, I would recommend that. Every CISO in industry, I don't know, in government as well, it's in most cases, is handed a book called The First 90 Days, meaning you're not only managing down the people that work for you, but you manage up as well, because it has to align with what your leadership and your business and your mission and organization is doing. But you also have to manage sideways as well, your peers.
Mm-hmm.
I think that book's helped me a lot. And I highly recommend for folks that are stepping into an organization as an executive that's going to be working on as a chief AI officer. You have to win the stakeholders as well. You can't just do this in silo, and you can't just focus on technology. Like I mentioned, you have to think about biases and safe, secure, trustworthy AI as well. So you have to look at all the business function. You have to make friends with the budget folks, civil rights, acquisition, HR, personnel security, everything, everybody that's there that's going to be voting members as well. They should have a voice in how you carry this out, because AI touches everything.
Everything,
to be honest with you. And anything that has the word IT in it, AI is going to be there. So The First 90 Days is highly recommended, as well as The Art of War as well, if you want to get deeper.
Yep, those are both fantastic books. All right, we'll make sure that we mention those in the LinkedIn post when this goes live. So I love the fact, one of the things you talk about, AI strategy. So we go back to the three main points. What is an AI strategy? What makes it good? Then we transition to the AI sandbox, which I think is a brilliant point that you had. Right? Strategy is both outwardly focusing, got to start with the mission and the vision, but then inwardly focusing, what's the culture and the ability of that organization to go deliver on that strategy? Now, there's something really neat in this AI sandbox, which is, now, how do you actually get people conditioned to delivering? So talk a little bit about where this came from. Why are you that big on this AI sandbox for Fed?
As I mentioned earlier, education is so big.
Yeah.
And culture, like you mentioned, culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yeah.
Looking at the culture and the strategy and a lot of AI work at the time, at least a lot of the AI purchase at the time were being bought by the business folks,
mm-hmm.
not within the CIO and the CISO office or even the CTO's office, meaning that the business folks, what do they care about? Efficiency, right? They want to move mm-hmm. fast. They want to deliver. They want to serve the American citizens fast. But a lot of them are not too familiar with the compliance and the governance portion. Like, they don't understand FSMA. Help. Heck, most of them didn't know that we have executive orders on AI and ethical and responsible, safe security principle around AI. So there's a lot of education that needs to happen, a lot of silo as well as in terms of sharing lessons learned and best practices. Having that support system helps a lot. And then also capturing what people are doing, right? Having an mm-hmm. inventory, who's doing what, and then really defining what is AI and what's not AI. Because you can't manage something you can't measure. So you have to look at, some people would consider bots AI, or some people consider RPA AI,
mm-hmm.
some people consider chatbot AI, but you have to truly identify that if there's no intelligence, it's not AI. It's just getting an AI sandbox in place to not only kick the tires, right? Test it out before you buy big purchase, and then testing out, but also baking in all the laws and regulations and the ethical principle and the responsible principle in the data pipeline and the AI pipeline makes a lot of sense, in my opinion. Yeah. And this is just me talking that, because in a regular IT, you develop, you test, you deploy. In some cases, you do a user acceptance test as well. There's more so a need to test things out when it comes to AI and not spending so much money on AI and then having it fail or delay or pushing to the right. But to test it out, kick the tires, and then baking in all the laws and regulations, and then education as well. And then also you're shifting the culture and the workforce to really embrace AI as well. Because, some people are afraid of AI.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned this when we had a prep talk, and I mentioned this at the conference too. Imagine you are a CIO, a CISO, a business owner back in the 80s, and you heard about the internet. And you're like, oh, yeah, I'm not going to use that thing called internet. There's a lot of risk. There's no standardization in there. There's not enough standards in there. And look at where we now. So AI is here. AI is the future. Might as well approach it in a safe, secure, and responsible manner. And the AI sandbox makes so much sense to me.
There's something related to your idea on the sandbox that a buddy of mine who worked in the state agency here in Texas that responsible for IT purchasing for all the different agencies. And one of the things that we talked about in a big agile session that we gave at one of the state conferences. This is going back on 2017. But what he wanted to flip the bit was, instead of giving one vendor or one person your RFO, and you're sitting there doing all these paper exercises around what this could be, why not take, and then just, you know, for one of the larger agencies, the hypothetical example, if you're going to spend $1 million to develop requirements for this big system, why not split that up between 5 vendors, 10 vendors, and do like the sandbox towards the thing you're trying to solve? And then take the aggregate of that to figure out, now you could actually see, instead of envisioning doing paper exercises, napkin exercises, how you'd solve that problem, now you can experiment and then end up with very good information around what your approach could be. You might learn that something that you wanted to do would break, right? And wouldn't work at all. So I think that's when I saw your article, and I love, by the way, because you published the article on my birthday.
Happy birthday.
It's a pretty cool article because of that. But I think I was thought that this, your what you're positioning with the sandbox could very much serve that kind of same notion of let government experiment, let government become more informed, hits that education piece. And then that provides, maybe that RFO you're going to put out is not going to be nearly as big as you thought because you reduced risk by doing those sandboxes.
So. Yeah, I mean, I have reviewed in my career, in my federal government career, I must have reviewed over thousands and thousands of proposals. Yeah. The one of the most important part is past performance, de-risking, because just working with the government is tough, right? Because there's a lot of, it's very heavily regulated. But having that understanding that you work with the government and whatever you've done has actually gone through the red tapes and gone through the rigors of the government, de-risking, so to speak, it's important that you de-risk and help serve the government. Because AI brings a lot of benefits, right? You could do more with less. You could empower the workforces. Mm-hmm. But the other half of CIOs and CISO in the government are stiff-arming, so to speak. Hey, let's slow down on this AI thing. Let's look at it. Let's make sure that we completely understand and make sure that we do it in a safe, responsible, secure manner. And that's why the AI sandbox makes complete sense. Just for me, having conversation with executive across the federal government.
To stand up a sandbox today, like what to you, from a government standpoint, what is it? What's the problem statement? What does it help solve? And then what are some good things that they see when you're going to implement this? What kind of teams do you need? Or what's the thing that organizations need to consider when they're doing these sandboxes?
One, you have to tie it to the AI strategy as well. Mm-hmm. It has to tie to that. And why are we doing it? It depends on, in terms of the workforce, it depends on how big is your workforce internally. Are you heavily outsourced? Because some agencies are very heavily outsourced in terms of having third-party vendors. They call them system integrators that are really managing your IT environment.
Okay.
You have internal teams that are really focused on AI, and that's not many agencies like that are in-house, because it's so hard to find good AI talent, not just outside, but inside the federal government as well. So you have to consider, that's why the strategy makes so much sense. You have to consider that as well. And then looking at the inventory, you always have to collect the inventories of who's doing what across the department, because there's maturity in the AI journey. Some people are just looking very simple linear regression. Something simple, just look at patterns and predict something, or just go mine a bunch of unstructured data and tell me what type of data I have, or put it in a, go from a data lake to a data warehouse. So it depends on what you want to do. But I think the critical essentials that is needed on AI sandbox, you need a data pipeline, and then you need an AI pipeline. I think those have to be separated, because some data pipeline could be used for analytics, RPA. You might not even use it for AI. So having that separation, you have more flexibility. And then applying all ethics and responsible AI principle into the both pipelines. And then the sandbox could be, it doesn't have to be one cloud provider, to be honest with you. Because when you look at the sandbox, there's different capabilities that come in it, different services. It's almost like an IT system, right? It doesn't have to come from Microsoft, Google. We would like to come from Microsoft, but let's say the server could be, the cloud could be Azure. Then something else could be sitting on top of that with third party. Yeah. And then you have integrators from different teams, so it's very diverse team. But the sandbox is so big that, you know, you could include different vendors, different technology, different capability. It's not a one-size-fits-all type of thing. And it depends on how mature you are in your IT capability. So as I talk to this, a lot of stuff is about culture and the maturity of your program and the workforce and the size of the organization. Then you get to the technology, which is the second part of that.
And I think that's an important point that you mentioned that probably couldn't be underlined enough, and what my friend Herschel was talking about when we mentioned pick 10 vendors, spend that $1 million of them, do your RFO. Because as the respondent to many different RFPs, one of the most frustrating things I see is like a lack of information in the vast majority of RFPs about the culture and the team that I'm going to be working with. And those frequently, and it's almost something some of the first questions I ask during the question and answer period is like, who are we going to be working with? What's the team? And people are typically baffled when we ask those questions. They're like, why do you need to know that? That's everything. I need to know who we're going to be working with, how you want to work. If you just describe what you want in the RFP, that's just like one piece of it, but it doesn't help me understand how I'm going to be, back to your point on de-risking that. So you mentioned a little bit then about, you also talked hand in hand about AI Sandbox and the data brokerage. Why was that like the next thing that kind of came out in your ideas here?
It's not just my idea. I think what I do well when I was in the government was that I talked to everybody. I'm very human-centered design, user-centric design, so to speak. I talk to a lot of people because at the end of the day, those are the guys that's going to be using the system. I'm just facilitating the technology for them. I'm not building the technology for Oki. I'm building it for the workforce.
Yeah.
So by listening to them and then looking at the overall strategies and the mission and the business and the laws and regulation comes with it, makes sense. The data brokerage makes sense. And here's why. People want to do AI, right? It's fun. Mm-hmm. It's sexy. It's moves things fast. But 80-90% of the work is around data. You really need a data strategy before you even get to the AI part. You have to classify your data. You have to have some sort of data strategy and data cataloging, who has what data across the department. Health data is very dispersed across not only within Health and Human Services, but our partners, the hospitals, university, academia, industry as well, insurance is dispersed across the board. When we look at getting the data for health data, it's very difficult for folks to share. And I said this in a conference last week. Health researcher rather share toothbrush than their data. So there's not much sharing of data. And most of it is just, hey, we have PHI or PAI or HIPAA, go away type of thing. But being a good data owner, a data steward owner, would help a lot in terms of AI, meaning I classify my data, I categorize correctly. It's almost like running a library, right? If you throw a lot of books in there and you don't categorize, index, nobody could find anything in that building. Yeah. But, and then you're just like, oh, you can't get it because I don't know what you want. It's HIPAA data. You can't get it anyway. So by categorizing and having a data brokerage, I could go to you and say, like, hey, I need this type of data. It doesn't fall under HIPAA or PHI or PII. Then it's easy to negotiate. And not only that I know where the data reside across the agency or even outside the agency as well. I keep the data where it is, meaning you keep your data where it is. You opt into this program. I just have your metadata. I just know where your data reside. And I can negotiate data. Because you don't want to centralize all the data. One, that could be a security risk. But not only that, then you become ownership of that and you got to pay for storage. You got to pay to safeguard it. It's basically a whole new system. It brings a lot of security issues and cost issue and just managing issue. But keep the data where it are. We just need data, metadata. We just need to know where it resides, like a library index catalog. Keep the books where they are. When we need it, we'll request it. That's why I think the data brokerage makes sense in so many ways. It's a precursor to even AI, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Because if you have bad data, it's all over the place, it's not fully classified. And when the data is like garbage in, garbage out, right? When the data comes in the AI, then it's hard to track it from a system perspective. There's a lot of data leakage, so to speak. And then not only that, if you don't have a good data loss prevention program, which Microsoft does a really good job in our purview capability. You can't track where it goes, and it could pose a very big risk to the organization.
I love that phrase, the health researcher would rather share their toothbrush than their data. As soon as you're saying that, as a health researcher, I can calculate the risk in sharing my toothbrush. I don't know how to calculate the risk right now in sharing my data. So yeah. I'm going to bet on that one because I know. But I think to me, that is one of the nice points when you start thinking about data brokerage. Because if I start with the mindset from the very beginning that I will need to share this data, then I'm going to hopefully, but it pushes people a little more to think about than the things that they need to do with that data, right? Just like I might adopt different practices in what I do in managing my household if I know I'm going to have people over every day.
Correct.
Right? I might actually train my dog a little better. She's overly friendly. She runs up and kisses everybody that comes in. It's like the kids leave a lot of stuff laying around at times, right? So I would change patterns and practices if I knew people were coming over a little time, just like I might change patterns and practices if I knew I might not be sharing this data today, but I know it's going to be shared at some point. So I might as well start thinking about that from the very beginning. And that means it leads to different management practices if I have that mindset.
Yeah. One other thing I want to add, Sid, is that, hey, this is a opt-in type of thing, opt-in, but I think you could tie it to the FSMA Act, meaning mm-hmm. for a system, before they go live into production, you have to assess and authorize, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can't go live. But then security is around data, right? Go to FedRAMP, ATO process, authority to operate. You look at the data first. That's the first thing you look at. How do we safeguard? Is it high risk, moderate risk, low risk, or public information, or national security data? So you start with the data. Why not, if you're going to go through this process, which everybody needs to, why don't you mandate that, hey, you need a data dictionary? Because in the document, in the ATO document, you have to have a data dictionary. You have to classify your data. We could build a data catalog off that requirements. Because having done it from an experience perspective, you try to piggyback existing laws and regulation and policy as much as possible. It gets things done faster. So why not just jump on and say, oh, you're going to go through this process. Make sure you have a data catalog, data dictionary. And then we could start capturing the data. We just need to know where the data reside and are you classifying the data. And that helps the CDO as well.
Yeah.
So everything intertwined, right? Everything has to be one, moving in one unit from the secretary to the administrator to the director to the IT security folks, privacy folks, acquisition. Everything has to move in one unit for this to work. And that's why I think the strategy makes sense. Otherwise, everybody be doing in silo, and then you dig yourself in a bigger hole.
To me, that's part of the brilliance in the way you frame things up, because as a data practitioner, I absolutely have a lot of sympathies for like CISOs and CDOs and everybody who needs to secure the data, right? Because it's scary thinking about trying to do new and different when I'm already fearful about what's happening inside my walls right now, right? So get it. We need to go classify the data so I understand everything that's out there, understand my risk, and then I can start understanding what I'm saying yes to when people are asking for more. At the same time, duct tape and baling wire kind of guy, let's go get stuff done. So why aren't we moving? So I think that's the brilliance in the sandbox concept that you're talking about, because then that allows for there to be progress. It's like what we term when I talk about with clients is like your new value creation track versus your capability track. When you start thinking about from the data sharing, data brokerage standpoint, I'm going to increase my capability to manage my data. When I do the sandbox, I'm go pursuing new value, right? And so I'm able to propel the organization forward without necessarily fully slowing it down because I'm trying to deal with my capability to do and manage data.
Yeah, so, a lot of stuff we talk about order to possible for AI. Mm-hmm. We talk about it, but show us.
Yeah.
I have a data catalog and AI sandbox. I could do a simple linear regression and show you, or I could help you catalog your data better, but just showing them just a little proof of concept, then you could get people on board more than just talking about it, because some people are very visual. They want to see, and it's practical and not just a pipe dream, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned you just spoke at a conference last week. You've got a pretty full schedule. What are some of the things that you're people should watch out for as far as presentations or new articles? What are you thinking about and going to be writing about next?
I don't do a lot of conferences. I try not to. I did so much in the federal government.
Yeah.
I try not to. I do them once in a while when I have something new that I want to talk about. But I think that just me talking to different CIOs and CISO in the federal government, I think the cyber elite is, I think that's the future. Meaning you want to collect as many data as possible so you know what's going on.
Yeah.
Not just security data, but business data as well, because there might be some anomalies that happen, because think about it, the bad guys are using AI as well.
Yeah.
So the internet, if you look at the internet, more than 64% of the traffic are by bots and AI. It's not even human traffic. Yeah. That's the majority of the traffic. So the cyber data lake makes sense. And the article that we wrote here is that centralized, hybrid, federated, depending on the big, how big the agency is, and running some sort of AI against it to identify anomalies. And it goes well with our Copilot, security Copilot as well. The second one is the responsible and secure AI sandbox, which we've been talking about for the past hour. Makes sense. Both of those documents doesn't mention any technology. We didn't even mention Microsoft. That's just the information we gather from different executives across the federal government and folks outside as well that are supporting the government. The goal at the end of the day is to serve the government. But the ensuing, we're going to do some follow-up document that's going to focus more on technology. But never start with technology. So the cyber data lake and the AI sandbox makes sense. I'm sure there's other stuff, quantum. I haven't digged too much into quantum. Even blockchain, we did some work around blockchain because in the government, there's a need for transparency and data origin of the data and just tracking things from place to places. But those two things coming down the pipe, and the follow-on would be the technology to support the cyber data lake and the sandbox.
I think that for the longest time, some of us have always felt like blockchain is the solution in search of a problem. I don't think it's what we're seeing is the store of value and the speculative, because it's not honestly being used for financial transactions. People are just storing. But the idea that you just mentioned, I couldn't agree with more, is like this immutability and showing chain, that custodial chain, that would be a really cool use case. Think journalism, think like voting records, like all sorts of things could be amazing there.
What's funny is, Sid, you hit it on the head there. We actually got authority to operate for our blockchain work back in 2018. And we didn't use it it's not anonymous. It's it's for our inside system. We had a thing called I forgot the name of it. It's to track data from finance system to acquisition system and then reporting it up to Treasury to make sure that, okay, we have full transparency in the cycle of the funding to spend, to buying, back to Treasury. We were just using the blockchain layer as an audit trail, basically to see who's doing what in terms of buying and buying on getting the funding and buying what from services to product and then reporting, because there was a lot of discrepancy, because at HSS, there's 5 acquisition system and 3 financial system alone. And then there's a reporting system at GSA and then it goes to Treasury. People actually go to GSA reporting system and making modification. So at that point, we didn't even know who's doing what, who's making the changes. So we used the blockchain layer, just a very light blockchain layer to capture Sid went in at this time making this change, and that's it. We just want an audit layer to capture everything in that process. It's good for transparency and visibility, and it's good for the American people too to know what the government is spending.
Yeah, I think that we talk a lot about the data product concept. It's like, hey, my first data product, maybe I stage data into the data lake, then I build derivatives off of that. So I've always thought like having some kind of supply chain logistics on my data, right? That was managed in a blockchain-esque type thing would be, then I can answer all the questions that you just talked about. So it's pretty cool that that might be another podcast on its own, just like that story there and what you learned.
I think we were 15 years ahead. I think blockchain is still a lot of opportunity for the federal government, because government's about transparency and data provenance, especially around health sector too. You want to make sure that the data that I requested or you requested, we know exactly what it's being used for.
Yep.
I think a blockchain, not it could be a hybrid blockchain,
Yeah.
That having that audit trail, auditability makes sense. Yeah, the program was called Accelerator. It was actually led by Jose Arrieta, who was a CIO at the time. And I was his senior advisor for Health and Human Services.
Awesome. Really interesting vectors that you're going down these days. Okay, I appreciate you making time for us today.
Yeah, it's been fun, Sid. Thank you so much for having me on. I like talking to you because you get it. I didn't have to explain it real well. You're just like, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, so, awesome. Appreciate it. Thank you for that compliment.